We're going to discuss today corruption. Corruption is a very difficult concept to define. If you look at even the law, the statute, so you know, some of them are easy, bribery, extortion, and then you have things like theft of honest services. Nobody apparently knows what theft of honest services is. They've gone to the Supreme Court. They've almost had it thrown out for vagueness. Basically, they want something that'll catch unethical behavior, the public servants behaving naughtily, public servants doing things for personal gain. Again, bribery is easy, but it's narrow. The question is, you know, what do you do? We all have a sense, you know, we know it when we see it. We all have a sense of what it means for a public servant to be behaving unethically, but how do you put that into a statute? So the legislators throw up their hands and they say, for purposes of this statute, someone who deprives through scheme or artifice the public of his intangibly defined honest services is guilty of theft of honest services, basically. So what is theft of honest services? So the Supreme Court, in an effort to save it, defined it as basically bribery and kickbacks. So it reduces kind of to a version, apparently, of bribery and kickbacks. So we're interested here in the Jewish law perspective on this. How do we define corruption? You know, what is corruption? What halachic sins, you know, what halachic rules do you violate when you are corrupt? I included here a couple of articles I'd previously written on the topic that touch on many of the things we'll discuss today. As you can see in the title of the first one, we have corruption in the judicial context, in the broader governmental context, legislative or executive. We have commercial corruption, people breaching their duties, their fiduciary duties, other types of duties. So that's one issue we have to clarify. What types of positions, what types of people are subject to corruption? What types of roles and capacities are subject to the halachic rules against corruption? And the other question, of course, is what is corruption? What type of behavior? Obviously, a bribe is a problem, but beyond that, what types of behavior are considered corruption? Halacha has no, Jewish law has no general term, no general category called corruption. So to begin with, to provide a framework by way of introduction, we'll discuss from the traditional Jewish law perspective, there are four categories of problems which bear on our question of conflict of interest and corruption, some more than others. But in order to understand the modern discussion of corruption, we'll begin with the classic Talmudic law, biblical law even, the categories of problems that the halacha, the Jewish law, recognizes. Again, we'll discuss whether they apply to judges, witnesses, other types of capacities. The four categories that we deal with are bribery, shochad in Hebrew. The Torah repeatedly tells you not to do that. Lo sikach shochad, shochad lo sikach. We had in the curses at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal we read recently, we had or lokach shochad, cursed is he who takes a bribe. Shochad is pretty clear, taking bribes is category number one. Category number two is not really an explicit biblical verse. Category number two is what we call nogea bedavar. In English, that turns into interest, basically, what we call an interested party. The original title of today's lecture had been the duty of disinterestedness. I actually preferred that, but the powers that be decided they wanted something a little less ponderous, so they went with neutrality. But interest and disinterestedness is really the more accurate technical term. The halacha has a notion that judges, that witnesses, that they are required to have no interest in the matter that they are involved with. Again, we'll have to define a little better what is the definition of interest, but that is the second category, someone who has an interest in the proceeding, interest in the outcome of whatever issue he's involved with, that is called nogea bedavar, or interest. Third category is called ohev en sone, a friend or an enemy. Hebrew is an interesting language. The word for like and love and friend and lover and are all kind of squashed together. The word ohev means to love, to like. So ohev in the Talmudic terminology means a friend or a very close friend. We'll have to discuss how close a friend do you have to be, but a friend or an enemy, if the judge or the witnesses are friends or enemies to the litigants, to the people who they have to pass judgment over, that can be a problem too. The fourth category is karov. This means near, literally it means relative, blood relative. This is the most rigorously, the most precisely defined of all four categories, and probably therefore, I guess, the least relevant in a general sense. You cannot be related, the judge, the witnesses cannot be related to the people whom they are judging. So exactly what's considered relative is defined at great length. Different levels of cousins, third cousins twice removed, fourth cousins once removed, and so on. All these things are discussed in great detail. usually this is not the kind of thing that comes up in judicial proceedings. The most relevant application of these laws that most of us will encounter is at weddings, where the witnesses to a Jewish wedding cannot be related to the bride and groom, so you have to be careful. Everyone knows his brother can't be the witness, but every now and then you get into some kind of situation with cousins and so on. But that's the most rigorously and precisely defined, blood relatives, that we're not really going to focus much on that. We're going to focus on the other three categories today: bribery, interest, and personal relationship with the litigants or the disputants. Now, just another introductory note. This is one area in judicial proceedings where halacha has a, traditional Jewish law has a somewhat different perspective than modern law does. In Jewish civil law, a judge or a witness can be disqualified based on a number of these criteria: being related to the litigants, being a too friendly with them, having an interest. Just as judges are automatically disqualified by being too close, so are witnesses. Unlike my understanding of the modern secular law system, where anyone testifies, the litigants themselves testify, their friends testify, everyone testifies, and then it's the job of the judge or the jury or whoever it is to sort out how much credibility to give to the testimony based on their understanding of who the person is. Halacha works on a very different model. Halacha simply disqualifies witnesses up front. We simply don't allow them to testify. We automatically discard any testimony they give if they violate one of these various rules. So the rules that govern judges are actually, in Jewish civil law, very similar to the rules that govern witnesses. We look up front whether they have any of these disqualifying things. If they do, we simply strike their testimony. We don't allow them to testify. The analogy to a legal concept would be one area which they do work in a similar way would be the laws of hearsay. Just as when it comes to something like hearsay, the law has, you know, dozens of rules and exceptions to exceptions, excited utterance and the dying declarations and all these things. When we do accept hearsay, when we don't accept hearsay, we don't simply say, let the jury decide whether they think this hearsay is credible or not. There are rules. There are formal rules established by law, established by precedent, however the rules are. There are rules that establish what kind of testimony is acceptable or not. So all these rules of interest and all that are applied to witnesses too in Jewish civil law as automatic formal disqualifications. If you fail on some condition, your testimony is simply discarded. You're not allowed to testify. It's struck. It's ignored, and so on. So that's the background. So again, halacha deals with these four categories: bribery, interest, personal relationship, and actual biological relationship, both with regard to judges and witnesses. All four of them can be disqualifying. There are certain differences between judges and witnesses. On the whole, we typically apply most of these rules to both of them in similar ways, to both judges and witnesses. We're going to focus today more on judges and not so much on witnesses. So suffice it to say, for the purpose of judicial disqualification, all these four categories apply and are reasons to disqualify a judge from presiding in a Beit Din, in a Jewish court, from presiding over a case. Now, obviously, some of these categories need further definitions, need to be defined a little more carefully. So in particular, we mentioned the notion of interest. Nogei b'davar means the judge has an interest in the outcome of the case. What is the definition of an interest? So the classic examples in the Talmud and the early codes are pretty much always financial interest. He stands to gain somehow financially from the case. Obviously, if he's a part owner in the business, that's obviously disqualifying, but this goes pretty far. So, for example, if a city, if a town is in a dispute with someone about a theft, about some kind of contract, and the judge is a member of the community, and he pays membership, and he benefits from communal property, he also may be disqualified because that's also considered an interest, a financial stake in the outcome of the case. So there are procedures for he can relinquish his share in the community. There are ways to do that, kind of like, just like politicians will sometimes put assets in blind trust, and they'll avoid having benefit from it and avoid being able to see what's going on. So there are certain procedures in classic Talmudic law for avoiding this. We're not going to get into the details, but in general, the classic literature, the early literature, typically defines interest as financial interest. The question then becomes, what about extending that to other types of interest, to interest of reputation, to interest of avoiding humiliation, disgrace, other types of interest that are intangible, that are non-financial, This is the subject of a major dispute beginning probably in the 16th century and running down for hundreds of years after that. This has been the subject of major dispute among halachic decisors as to whether the definition of interest should be extended to these types of intangible benefits. There's extensive argument on both sides. One very interesting debate, which has a lot of bearing on our topic, occurred in the 16th century. There was a historical and celebrated dispute in Israel between the sages of Tzfas and the sages of Jerusalem. The actual case was quite a colorful one. We're not actually interested in the substance. We're more interested in the process here. But the actual case was quite a colorful one. It involved the reestablishment of smicha, of rabbinic ordination. Today, rabbis do have smicha. They do have a kind of ordination. Today, it's really just a kind of copy, a kind of symbolic thing. It has very little rigorous halachic rules. There used to be a system of ordination in Talmudic times, which allowed you to do some pretty serious things, particularly alter the calendar and other things, which could have major ramifications. So there was a great dispute. So smicha, formal rabbinic ordination, had fallen into disuse for 1,000 years, more than that. There was a movement to reinstate it in the 16th century in Israel. Very colorful, very interesting episode. We're interested here more in the process than the substance. So there was a great dispute. The two camps were headed by Rabbi Yaakov Beirav in Tzfas. He was a teacher of the Rabbi Yosef Karo, the Shulchan Aruch. And on the other side was Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv. These were all Sfardim. Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv in Yerushalayim. They had a great dispute for reasons that are beyond the scope of our talk about whether smicha could be reinstated. Now, the community in Tzfas was much larger. The schools, the academies, they were much larger, the rabbinic community, than the one in Yerushalayim. So Rabbi Yaakov Beirav and his followers told Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv, this is what we say, this is our opinion. Levi ibn Chaviv says, I disagree. I dissent, as they say. So Rabbi Yaakov Beirav says, okay, we outvote you. We're the majority. So he said, nope. The rule is you need a quorum. You can't issue an opinion without first sitting down at the table with me and discussing it with me and hearing my opinions. You didn't do that. You simply issued your opinion on your own without consulting me. Your opinion doesn't count. They said, okay, even if you're right, we're talking now. Let's talk. Let's discuss. And then we'll go vote again. And we'll see what happens next time. So he said, Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv said, sorry, doesn't work. He says, you are all permanently disqualified from ruling on this issue. You have already gone on record. You have issued public statements to your opinion. If I now would convince you to retract, you would be humiliated. You would have egg on your face. You would have to admit that you had been hasty and jumped to an unwarranted conclusion. This would be difficult for you to do. You are no gabadaver. You have an interest in the outcome of the case now. You are therefore disqualified. You have to recuse yourselves from offering an opinion. They said, what are you talking about? Yeah, every judge is allowed to continue ruling even after others have talked to him and argued with him. There's no such thing that a judge becomes permanently disqualified because it would be embarrassing for him to have to back down. You know, here, sometimes the Supreme Court will hear a case, it'll send it back to the original court to issue a new ruling based on some aspect of their understanding being overruled. And no, we don't usually say the whole first court is disqualified. So again, the rules here, both as in law, the rules here can be very, very hazy sometimes, but this particular disagreement was one that echoed down throughout the generations. Rabbi Levi ibn Chaviv's hard line that the mere humiliation, the mere sense that he would be embarrassed and humiliated itself is a disqualifying factor. It's not, again, it's not financial interest, but the interest is simply in public reputation. That was enough, he felt, to disqualify. His opponents felt there was no such thing. Now, obviously, in this particular case, again, it's kind of circular because their interest, you know, bears on their being able to continue ruling also. So it's kind of a circular point, but we have to discuss what we think, whether, you know, injury to reputation is a factor, and this is a matter, again, of dispute going back centuries. So again, this is, I think, something of an open question, how we treat what the halacha calls negiya she'ena shel mamon, interest, which is non-financial. That is the subject of major dispute. Now, here we get to a point where the notion of interest, of nogea b'davar, begins to overlap with the notion of friends. As we mentioned, halacha has one category of being too friendly. If it's your close friend for 20 years, you shouldn't be hearing his case. Also, interest. If you stand to gain or lose by the outcome of a case, you also have a problem. There's a charming little responsum of Rabbi Yor Chaim Bacharach, 17th century authority. He relates a personal anecdote. He says, I once lent money to someone, neglected to get proper documentation. When I asked him for the money back, he brazened it out, he denied it, he said, never happened, and I had no proof, so I had to write off the debt. He said later, this guy came to me for a din Torah. He asked me to preside over a dispute he had with somebody else. I guess this is a testimony to the reputation for probity Rabbi Bachrach had, that people were willing to, this own guy who knew he had cheated him out of the debt, was willing to trust him to offer an honest opinion. So Rabbi Yor Chaim Bachrach, the author of the Chavos Yor, he recused himself from the case. He said, I will not judge this case. He said, not because I know he's a villain and I'm prejudiced against villains. The same Torah that told me to, in Psalms, King David says, Misanecha Hashem Esna, I hate those who hate you. He says, no, the same Torah that told me to do that also tells me to give everyone a fair hearing, to, you know, prior bad acts are not admissible in evidence. Everyone is entitled to a fair hearing for the matter at hand. However, he says, this was personal. He cheated me. He says, I did not feel that I could be impartial. Someone who had cheated me, who had refused to pay me back money that I was owed, I did not feel, and this is what every judge should do, he says, I did not feel that I could be impartial. So Rabbi Bachrach is invoking the notion of ohev and sone, of personal feeling, of enmity. I had the grudge against him. I was angry at him. Rabbis are human too. So I would not take his case, he says, because I did not feel that I could have an unbiased opinion in this case. But the question is, so far these categories are fairly narrowly defined. Personal enmity, okay. We mentioned earlier, blood relations are a problem, even relations by marriage. So as we said, the halacha discusses that in great detail, exactly what type of relationships are problems. There's a talk about mechutanim, about two sets of in-laws. Can they hear each other's case? So the assumption is yes. In principle, that kind of relationship, that their kids have married each other, is not disqualifying. However, sometimes they will fall afoul of the rules on personal relationships. Now, the assumption is we mean positive personal relationships. Sometimes the fathers and mothers of the bride and groom will like each other too much. And sometimes, I guess, the reverse is true also. But in general, you know, personal relationships are a problem. Interest in the case, familial relationships. The things that we would think of as disqualifying are often don't fall into any of these categories neatly. For example, your boss. Your boss tells you, look, I'm having a dispute with my neighbor. I know you moonlight as a rabbinic judge in your spare time. Would you mind presiding over this case I have with my neighbor? Nothing to do with the business, nothing to do with your employment. So there's no shochad. He's not giving you anything. There's no bribery here. He's not giving you anything for your services. There is no interest in the technical sense. You do not stand to gain or lose in any way by the outcome of this case. It's not a business case at all. It's his personal relationship with his neighbor. You may not particularly like or hate your boss. That's, you know, probably in many cases. You have no particular emotional feelings toward your boss, neither enmity nor warm friendship. You're certainly not related to him in many cases. So such a situation would not seem to fall under any of the four categories we mentioned. And indeed, there is nothing in black-letter law, in halacha, in Jewish civil law, that would disqualify a person from hearing a case of his boss. There are actually one or two statements in the early decisors, 16th century, 17th century, who explicitly discuss boss, and in passing they mention that it's not a problem, that the relationship is not even a student to a teacher, teacher of Torah, employee to employer, vice versa. These are not relationships that are inherently disqualifying. Any of us, I think, our immediate reaction would be that you'd have to be out of your mind to take a case that involves your boss. Even if he hasn't threatened to fire you if you rule against him, that's always there in the back of your mind. I mean, how can you possibly, you know that your career, your employment in this company, just a case I saw the other day, this was, there was a fellow who worked for the senior editor for The Verge, a popular online tech publication, who apparently several months ago took a job working for Apple, continued to work at The Verge for a month, neglected to tell his employers of his new employment, kind of gradually disappeared from the office, and was discovered several months later to be working for a major company covered by his media organization. Everyone recognizes this is a problem. So again, the question is, you know, under formal halacha, is there formal Jewish civil law, what category does this fall into? And it's hard to know. So again, this takes us back to the kind of the vagueness and theft of honest services stuff. Halacha, the halacha clearly indicates that a person has to have a sense of responsibility, a sense of common sense, even things which are not strictly forbidden by the law. You have to understand that some things are improper or unethical and should not be approached with a 10-foot pole. clearly it would be wrong, I think, for someone to take a case involving his boss. The early, the 16th and 17th century sources who discuss it, they might have been referring more to day laborers, to cases where the employment was a one-off, or cases where you know, there was reason to assume it wouldn't affect any, to believe it wouldn't affect his long-term prospects. But certainly the Torah recognizes that common sense has to play a role too, and you have no business taking cases that, you know, where there's such a potential for conflict of interest. But it's important to note that in terms of the formal black letter law, so to speak, rules established by the Torah, this doesn't easily fall into any of the categories we've discussed. And the truth is, if you can, going back again to secular law, American law, secular culture, it is surprising sometimes the things the law allows, the things the law does not allow, are almost without rhyme or reason. So, for example, for much of our republic, we had a spoil system where everything in government was, you know, to the victors go the spoils. That was actually the origin of the phrase, apparently, in the 19th century, was that incoming party puts all its people into public office. Does that make sense? I mean, does it make sense that the public should be served by people whose main qualification for the job is that they have supported, financially or otherwise, the political fortunes of the administration? I don't know. Even today, they passed the reform, post-Civil War, the Pendleton Act, and the Hatch Act. They passed all these things. So most civil service jobs today are not patronage, but ambassadors still are. Does it make sense that the person who represents the American foreign policy to other countries should be typically a wealthy person who supported the administration in its bid? I don't know. I mean, but you know, that's how the system works. So again, how you decide what is... While I was preparing for this, I saw, you know, I was reading someone's essay, someone's, you know, personal point of view, who was very much opposed to this business of ambassadors. He said there's some story that goes around where a fleet admiral was once talking to an ambassador. He gives the names. I don't recognize the names. But the admiral said, you know, when I retire from heading the 6th Fleet, I'm thinking of, getting myself appointed as ambassador somewhere. The ambassador said, you know, when I retire from being ambassador, I'm thinking of getting myself appointed as admiral of the 6th Fleet. So the admiral said, was I gassed? He said, like, don't you know that the admiral of the 6th Fleet requires a lifetime of expertise and familiarity with the system and skill? He says, don't you know that being the head of an embassy also requires, running an embassy also requires a lifetime of training and skill and experience? So yeah, why the system has developed the way it did to allow certain things we take for granted. It's obviously bribery is a problem, but you know, all the what types of patronage, what types of, again, people complain about the revolving door. People, congressmen sit on the energy committees, then they go out and, you know, get jobs as directors or as lobbyists for the companies that they've been legislating about or regulating. That's legal, apparently, and not, you can't do it while you're in Congress, but you know, the revolving door is legal. The problem, I guess, largely is that it's difficult to legislate. It's difficult to pass actual rules forbidding, or you could, I guess, pass, you know, lifetime bans, but whatever the reason, you know, these things haven't gotten passed. So what's legal, what's not legal? You know, that's why people don't like the theft of honest services rule, because anything the prosecutors and courts don't like, they can just decide violates theft of honest services. But again, going back to the, you know, Jewish civil law categories, we do have these fairly narrow, fairly well-defined categories. But beyond that, it's difficult to know, you know, what level of unethical behavior that we would intuitively think is unethical. It's difficult to give formal rules for what type of behavior is considered corrupt and unacceptable, and what kind is, you know, unfortunate maybe, but, you know, can't actually be blocked by the law. So I want to consider now a few actual responses, a few actual cases that were discussed by leading halachic authorities over the last several hundred years. Most of these cases are pretty black and white and probably won't, expand the horizons of what's actually forbidden. Most of these cases are, you know, they say hard cases make bad law. These actually, I think, are easy cases. They make good law, actually. But just to give you a feel for how some of the famous, or at least, you know, famous in halachic academic circles, some of the cases that are much discussed by various authorities. So the most famous probably is one that occurred in the early 19th century, in the time of Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer. This case involved elections for the position of rabbi in some community, some city. So they had a vote. The members of the community were going to vote, much as communities do today. They were going to vote for the position of rabbi. After the vote had occurred, a scandal broke that electors in the city, the citizens of this community, had been paid to to vote against certain candidates, for certain candidates. It was a fairly elaborate electoral procedure, kind of like with the Pope, with multiple rounds of elections, and with four yes or no votes, up, down, whatever it was. But there were allegations that emerged that electors had been paid to vote in favor of one of the candidates. So nothing had been proven. There was no actual trial. There were letters. There were rumors. But for our purposes, let's consider that the allegations were to be accepted as fact. Now, of course, the procedure, how do you establish, is all a separate question about procedural issues, but let's assume for the moment that these allegations are true. So what does that do for the outcome of this vote? So the Chasam Sofer rules unequivocally that the vote is thrown out. He says, regardless of whether it was the rabbi himself who commissioned this vote buying or simply friends and supporter of his, doesn't matter. The vote has been tainted by bribery. The vote is to be discarded. If the rabbi himself can be proven to have been involved in the vote buying, then not only is the vote discarded, he himself is barred from, disqualified from holding the position of rabbi, a character issue essentially. We would not have criminal sanctions for this, but certainly he would be disqualified from holding the position. Now, this is very interesting, because as we mentioned earlier, up till now, the examples of the formal, again, black-letter law of where the Torah has problems with corruption have generally been in the context of judges and witnesses. So what about government in general? What about political officials, executive, legislative? So there is very little literature on this in the early sources. It first emerges in 17th century.
What about the alleged electors that were involved in the bribery? They don't vote the next time?
That's an interesting question. I don't recall if he disqualifies them too from any future participation in the... Interesting question. Some of his analysis that we'll discuss soon might bear on that, but it's an interesting question. I don't remember if he explicitly comments on that.
I guess the question is, there's also a tradition of actually buying provision,
yeah,
for sons in law and so forth, and there's a machlokas on that.
Well, we'll touch on that soon, yes. So, beginning in the 17th century or so, we do have authorities in Jewish law who extend the notion of corruption to other people in positions of public trust who are not actually judges, not actually judges. The Torah, the Talmud always talk about dayanim, about judges. We do have some sources that extend it to other people in positions of public trust. What it means to be in a position of public trust is not well defined. It's kind of assumed that you know what that means. People who have authority over public funds, over public policy, are not supposed to be corrupt either and may violate the Torah's prohibitions even against bribery and so on if they take money or personal consideration. Now, the Chasam Sofer, in his case, he was arguing even further. He was arguing that the electors are subject to similar rules to that of judges, that they will be disqualified, their vote will be disqualified for similar reasons to judges. His source for that is a very interesting ruling going back centuries earlier to Rabbi Meir of Rottenburg, Maram of Rottenburg. The Maram of Rottenburg was issuing a fundamental ruling that it basically established democracy. We've discussed this in a previous lecture. He basically issued a profoundly important ruling establishing a democratic process as the basis for local decision-making. They came to him, the community said, we can't agree, we can't reach consensus, we can't reach unanimity on projects, funding, hiring people, we have problems, and what's our procedure, what should we do? His answer was basically democracy. People get together, they vote, and the majority's decision shall be binding. This was a major precedent for centuries for local government in practice, not in theory. And this is post-Talmudic, this is in European countries. Local decisions should be made democratically. Now, the Maram of Rottenburg, when he expresses this rule, he says, everyone must express his opinion l'shem shamayim. Everyone must express his view for the sake of heaven. He doesn't define what that means. And no one really paid much attention to that language until the Chasam Sofer, several hundred years later. The Chasam Sofer said, Maram of Rottenburg is telling us that electors, not public officials, the electors in a city who are voting in a plebiscite, in a referendum, they have to express their opinion l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven. So the Chasam Sofer says, whatever that means, what it certainly means is that you not be bought. Certainly one whose vote is bought by interested parties is not expressing his opinion for the sake of heaven, and that therefore disqualifies the vote. This is an amazing thing, because as I understand it, while I'm not a serious student of political philosophy, In our culture, in our world, we believe certainly public officials have to be disinterested. We believe judges, legislators, civil servants, executive branch, the legislative branch. We don't believe that an elector, meaning you and me, have any duty to be disinterested. If I vote for president, for congressman, I have no duty to set aside, certainly no legal duty, I don't even know if anyone thinks I have an ethical duty, to set aside all my personal interests and say, if I were outside, you know, there is Kantata rule, I forget what it's called, about his ethical imperative is, what would you do if not knowing, it wasn't Kant. Sorry? I'm sorry? Rawls, right. Thank you. The Rawls's rule was what would you do if you didn't know who you'd be born into, rich, poor, American, Pakistani? What policy would you have? I don't think, you know, there are ethical theories that require that, but I don't think in the real world most of us think we have a duty to vote based on those principles, to ignore our taxes, our interests, to ignore everything and simply vote to what we think is the best for the sake of world society. Maybe there are some people who are lofty enough to vote like that, but Maram of Rattenberg, as understood by the Chasam Sofer, essentially is claiming, if you take it to that extent, that an elector, a private citizen who votes in an election on a question of public interest, has to vote l'shem shemayim, has to vote for the sake of heaven. What does that mean? If you're the local stonemason and there's a vote up about whether to do some construction, are you required as a public citizen to recuse yourself because you have an interest, because you would like this project to be greenlighted? I don't know. It's a tremendously stringent standard. And again, Chasam Sofer is not saying that explicitly. He's just saying that you shouldn't be bribed. But if you take it to that logical conclusion, that that might be where you end up, although I'm really not sure if anyone actually does that. Yes?
Yeah, but I mean, the one thing we do have, though, is politicians can't pay for actual votes. So you can't be everyone votes in their self-interest, or at least they're supposed to.
Right. But no, absolutely, right.
At the very extreme of things. Even Starbucks can't give you a free cup of coffee on election day.
Absolutely right. No, I understand. And so in terms of the Chasam Sofer's actual holding, it is as you said, it is exactly in line with modern expectations too. You cannot pay for voting. But in terms of the theory behind it, the way he expresses this theory, it seems that it could be extended further. Again, he doesn't do that, right? But you're right. The actual holding is perfectly in line. Yes.
Does that mean that the majority of votes in the Israeli government are obsolete?
Because.
Very often there is some kind of exchange.
Horse trading and interest in money for schools, money for pet, in America we call it pork, pork project. I'll vote for your health care bill if you give me $50 million to expand my airport or whatever, right? So again, right, I don't know. Nobody actually says that. Nobody goes so far and makes that claim. But that's the question. Yes, I don't think it just sounds that would be going too far. Although again, in theory, you wonder how far to take this. That was a famous tshuva, a famous response of the Chasam Sofer. Another case I like to quote is this one is a response of a late 19th century figure, Rabbi Shlomo Yehuda Tabak, the author of the Tshura Shai. He talked about a case. This is just, I don't know where to start on this one. He talks about a case. There was a local governing board, the famous Zion Tuvei Ha'er, a local Jewish town, community, governmental body. They were voting on some kind of tax to impose on a certain industry. I think it was wine. And they needed to raise money for whatever it was, general revenue, a specific project. So there was a debate about whether to impose a specific tax on a specific industry. One of the seven-member council, these freeholders, whatever you call them, actually was in the wine business. Didn't seem to have occurred to anybody that he should be recusing himself from this vote. He was going to vote on this tax. Now, somebody thought that he would vote against it. Somebody was assuming he would be voting his self-interest, but somebody actually wanted this tax to go into effect. So he bribed the guy to correct his inherent conflict of interest. He bribed the guy to overlook his personal needs and to vote. I don't know if he actually asked for a specific vote or he just paid him to vote his conscience. I'm not sure. But he basically, the bottom line is, his actual treatment, Rabbi Tabak's treatment of the case, does not involve these layers within layers. He just treats it as a simple case of bribery. Basically, to simplify, he bribed one of the seven freeholders to vote the way he wanted. The decision came down, the decision that was taken was unanimously in favor of what this guy wanted, in favor of the tax. It was a 7-0 decision. And then the bribery turned up. And the question is, what should be done with this vote? So the argument was, I mean, okay, so let's say we strike this guy's vote. So it's six. You know, it's, six is still a supermajority. And so six is more than enough. Rabbi Tabak said, no, the entire vote is discarded. And one of his main arguments harkens back to what we mentioned earlier with the debate in 16th century Israel about the procedural rules of quorums. He argues that it's true that even if it's true that these bodies can operate based on majority, you do need a quorum. You can't just hold a meeting with six members present and pass resolutions. You need all seven members, he says. And even though, he says, some communities had the rule that if somebody was absent or dead or incapacitated or away on a trip, that they would be able to proceed in his absence, he says, they made a special exception because that was necessary. It was practical reasons they couldn't always assemble a quorum. They certainly, you know, certainly we shouldn't assume that they allow a quorum of six when you strike one guy for corruption to proceed. So basically he argues that you do not have a quorum. Moreover, and he makes a much more powerful and interesting argument, moreover he argues, and this is a point made by other scholars also, he argues the taint of bribery, presumably can spread to the other electors. They all discuss the matter together. Once one guy's opinion is tainted, if he's particularly persuasive, he may be able to convince other people of his opinion. So the bribery kind of infects all the electors, even though they never heard of the bribe, they never saw the bribe, but they're listening to this silver-tongued guy, and his silver tongue is being activated by silver in his wallet, and one way or another, the whole thing becomes corrupt because of this initial bribe that he explains the pasuk in a clever way. Biblical verse is, Ki hashachad yaverein epikhim v'yisalef divrei tzadikim. The bribery can blind the eyes of the tzadikim and righteous men and others. He said it. The guy who took the bribe is not a tzadik. He's a rasha. He's a villain, he says. But it means even those who are tzadikim who never took the bribe, he says that the bribery spreads and in fact taints everything, and the entire vote has to be discarded. Just one other response from the same author. Again, these are not necessarily difficult cases, most of these, but they're, you know, interesting to see how they were handled by some of the major halachic authorities. He himself discusses another case. This again, has a very, I think, modern feel to it, but unfortunately. But I don't mean that we're worse than any other period in history, but kind of we can see these headlines in the newspaper. There were two Jews who wanted a certain government concession, government contract, we'll call it. So the contract was supposed to be offered at public transparent auction. One person didn't really want to pay the price that the contract he would have had to at an open public auction, so he paid off some of the officials involved to give it to him in a no-bid secret contract. Other guy found out what had happened, so he went over his head. He either blew the whistle on him, or he bribed, you know, he outbid him in the bribery department, whatever he did. He basically took the contract away from him by outbidding him. The first person was not happy with this result. He actually had, I guess this is one of those classic things that fall under definition of chutzpah, he actually took the second guy to a din Torah, to a rabbinic tribunal, that for unfair competition, for encroaching on his livelihood by doing this. Rabbi Tabak threw the case out. He dismissed the claim on a number of grounds. All his grounds really boil down to the same thing, that since the first guy was behaving sinfully, improperly, criminally, he has no right to invoke any rabbinic judicial protection for what he's doing. As to what exactly he did wrong, so he gives a whole litany of different counts of why exactly his conduct in bribing government officials to get him a no-bid contract violates the many different strictures of Jewish law. One of them is bribery. One of them is theft. It's essentially theft of a public resource, or government resources are public resources. There are Jews in the city. It's the government, he says. So anyway, he says, it's theft, it's bribery, it's on all kinds of counts. He says, what you're doing is absolutely criminal, and therefore you have no right to ask for any protection under the Torah law. Now, getting to the question now of selling rabbinic positions. So here we turn to a responsum slightly after that, maybe early 20th century, perhaps. This is a responsum of Rabbi Malkiel Tenenbaum, the Divrei Malkiel. This is a ruling that I have a bit of a hard time with. Not because his conclusion is I would have ruled differently, but because I'm a little kind of disappointed. He didn't rule more full-throatedly, making the point I would have expected him to make. He deals with the following situation. The custom was, as Elliot mentioned earlier, the custom was that rabbinic positions used to be bought and sold. Specifically, the arrangement he was talking about was that the outgoing rabbi, when a rabbi retired, he would charge the incoming rabbi some kind of fee, essentially, for vacating the position and allowing the new one would still have to be appointed by the community. And it wasn't that he could just privately install his successor. The community would still have to negotiate a contract and hire a new person. But he had a kind of veto right. He would have to be paid off for the position before the new candidate could be installed. So there was once a guy, a rabbi, who was retiring. He was leaving his position in some European city. He was making aliyah. He was going to Eretz Yisrael. So the terms of the deal he made with the incoming candidate was, I want so-and-so many ruble in cash up front. Additionally, he told the new candidate, your father-in-law controls charity funds that are earmarked for the support of European Jews who make aliyah and live in Eretz Yisrael. I am a Jewish person making aliyah and going to Eretz Yisrael. I want a guarantee that 50 rubles a month from this charity fund that your father-in-law controls shall be given to me. Neither of them seemed to have had any problem with this deal. That neither doesn't seem to have occurred to anybody here there's anything wrong with this deal. Those are the terms of the deal. He sold the rabbinic. Now, we're not going to get into the question of whether the sale of rabbinic positions in the first place is appropriate or not. As Elliot mentioned, it was a pretty standard custom in much of Europe. So, not going to get into that. But let's assume that it's okay to sell rabbinic positions. Again, the community still gets to vote and still gets to hire the candidate they want, but you're entitled to some kind of compensation for leaving the position. The question was, is this deal, where part of his compensation would be from charity funds controlled by the counterparty, is there anything wrong with this deal? That wasn't even the question. The question that Rabbi Tenenbaum was asked had to do with reneging on the deal. He decided not to make aliyah. Is the deal binding? Is such a contract enforceable? Nothing to do with the fact there's anything wrong with it. There was just a technical, contractual question. But in the course of his analysis, he begins to discuss the question, like, wait a second, is this deal kosher in the first place? Are you allowed to buy, can a man buy a rabbinic position for his son-in-law using public funds that he controls? I said I wasn't going to get political, but this is the sort of thing that, you know, both candidates are being dragged into, you know, pay-for-play type of allegations in the current election. So is there anything wrong with such behavior? So how exactly would you categorize this as you're using a public position, a position of public trust, in this case your stewardship of charity funds, of public funds, you're using your position for personal gain. On the other hand, you're not necessarily acting against the interests of the person, of the public. You are giving the funds to a qualified recipient. He is a perfectly qualified recipient. So how do we define, is this wrong and why is it wrong? So he actually is not comfortable with this. Now, I would have preferred some kind of fiery denunciation of this practice. He doesn't quite manage to do that. The way he phrases it is, that as a steward of public funds, as we mentioned earlier, as an official with a position of public trust, you have a duty of disinterestedness, of integrity. There should not be anything weighing on you and affecting your decisions. Your decision to give this guy money, you clearly have an interest there. The interest is securing a position for your son-in-law. So you become a negeh, but Davari says you have an interest in the case, and therefore you should not be making this decision. I would have thought the fact that you're taking something for personal gain should be something more serious than simply a failure of disinterestedness, but that's really the best he can do in terms, again, black letter Jewish civil law is limited in the categories that apply here, and that is the only one he can really come up with. Initially, he calls it theft, but then he backs down and says, maybe I can't really call it theft if you're simply disposing of the money in a way which is in accordance with the rules of the charity fund you're administering. So the best he can do is to say that your judgment is tainted and you really have no business making the decision anymore insofar as you have some interest there. And this brings us to one final case I'll discuss, which is a contemporary case out of Israel. I don't know if this was a real case or this was a case study for analysis. Unfortunately, it sounds, I guess, all too real. The case was a woman applied for a teaching position in a certain school. The principal told her, I have many applicants for this position. You will have to wait in line. However, your father, he said, controls a factory. My son could use a good position in that establishment. I think the way he phrases it delicately or not so delicately was, if your father would help, you know, in Israel, I think they call this, you know, one hand washes another. If your father would hire my son in an appropriate position, I would feel indebted to you, hakara satov, to give you precedence in the hiring. So the question was, what has this principle done wrong, if anything, by making such an arrangement? So one question he discusses is shochad, bribery. The principle is taking something for personal gain. Now, it wasn't personal gain, it was for his son's gain, but that he establishes that's close enough to be called, that's enough to be considered bribery. Halacha often says, Jewish civil law often says, if you ask for money to be given to someone else who you designate, that's treated, a law called Arev, that's treated as if you took the money yourself. So that would be sufficient to meet the criteria of bribery. The question, again, as you mentioned earlier, is that classic bribery applies to judges, to witnesses, to electors, people who are involved in making decisions on behalf of the public. It is not clear that a school necessarily would qualify. Now, schools come in different flavors. There are public schools, there are private schools, there are some which are, you know, completely private and internally run. There are some that are semi-private, which are technically run by a board of directors but are expected to serve the interests of the community. There are some that are totally public, run by the government. I don't know exactly what kind of school this was. But again, it's not a slam dunk to say that the formal, again, obviously this is a kind of reprehensible thing to do, but it's not clear this would violate necessarily the formal category of bribery. For that, you would need presumably some level of public trust. If you violate your employer's trust in you, a private employer, purchasing manager who takes a kickback, it is not clear that he violates the formal, again, black letter law of bribery, because he's not a judge. Even if judge is extended to mean person in position of public trust, it is a very big jump, which I don't think we have a reliable precedent for, to extend that to people in private, commercial, fiduciary relationships. The other issue that this rabbi discusses, though, is the question, a broader question, the question of simply, I guess, you know, similar to theft of honest services, to what he calls Gnevis Das, which is a hard word to translate. It means something like deceiving, not being honest, not being straight with your employer, acting in a way that if he knew he would not condone and probably cause for termination, acting in a way that you know it is quite clear, it is perfectly evident that your employer would not tolerate, would consider intolerable. If you're in his employ and you're taking his silver and he trusts you and he compensates you certainly, and then you betray him by acting in ways that are not in accordance with generally accepted practices, that are not in his best interest, then you're perpetrating some kind of fraud, some kind of deceit over against your employer, and that's like a contractual issue. You're taking his, you know, he trusts you, and you're betraying his trust. Again, this takes us very far from the original categories of corruption and bribery, but this is a kind of broader thing. Again, I was told in some grocery stores, even, you know, nationally, even big ones, that the purchasing manager will tell individual stores, if you want me to stock your product, I you have to give me something under the table. So exactly what are you doing wrong? Obviously, if you're breaking the law, then you're guilty of whatever criminal offense the law says you are, and halacha would probably recognize that and tell you that you need to follow that law. But in terms of the native halachic rules, the native Jewish civil law rules that would govern this, it is far from clear. Again, it is much more serious if you clearly, unequivocally are acting against your employer's interest. For example, if in a case, let's say, the purchasing manager, if you're paying an inflated price, you're essentially stealing money from your employer. If the market rate for this good would be $10 a pound, and because he gives you a kickback, you pay him $12 a pound out of your employer's money, you're essentially stealing money from your employer. This point is made by Rabbi Chaim Halberstam of Sanz. He talks about a case of an estate manager who is going to rent out property on behalf of his principal. He rented it out at below market costs and took money on the side in exchange for doing this. He says that money he took, he doesn't discuss what criminal category it falls into. He just says that money he took, it's no different from siphoning off the rent, whether he actually charged full rent and then took some of the rent and put it in his pocket, which is simply theft. In this case, he charged 80% of the rent, took money under the table. That money he took is simply money that belongs by right to the owner of the estate. It's a similar here, the purchasing manager case, if he actually paid too much for the product, he essentially stole that money from his employer. That's theft. But if he made a decision which is not objectively wrong, like in the case of the teacher, he hired a teacher, she may be qualified, we don't know there was anything inferior about her than 100 other candidates. So in the case where there is no clear standard by which he acted against the employer's interest, except for the fact that inherently taking personal consideration is almost by definition against the employer's interest, because the reason for it, obviously, is one reason at least, is because it could lead to activities that are against the employer's interest. But that's much harder to define what it could be. And one theory is it's a form of deceit and fraud. Again, and we're back to kind of the territory of theft of honest services. We're not sure exactly what it is, but if it's behavior that is clearly seen as unethical, you shouldn't be doing it. The Torah certainly recognizes that, even if it's hard to pinpoint and define exactly what category it falls into.